Welcome to Beyond the Thesis with Papa PhD, the podcast that delves into the diverse and impactful roles scientists can play beyond the lab, with me, David Mendez. Today, I have the great pleasure of having with me Gloria Mark. Gloria is Chancellor's Professor Emerita at the University of California, Irvine, and also spent 10 years as a visiting senior researcher at Microsoft Research. She received her PhD from Columbia University in psychology. And for over two decades, she's researched the impact of digital media on people's lives, studying how using our devices affects our multitasking, distractions, mood, and behavior. Gloria has published over 200 papers in the top journals and conferences in the field of human-computer interaction, has received numerous paper awards, and was inducted into the ACM Sig Chi Academy in 2017 in recognition for her contribution to the field. She has also been a Fulbright Scholar and has received the prestigious NSF Career Grant. Her work has been widely recognized outside of academia. She has appeared on The Ezra Klein Show, NPR's Hidden Brain, Sanjay Gupta's CNN Chasing Life, CBS Sunday Morning, Dax Shepard's Armchair Expert, among many others. Gloria's work has been featured in the popular media, for example, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, NPR, etc. And she's been invited to present her work at South by Southwest and the Aspen Ideas Festival. Her recent book is Attention Span, A Groundbreaking Way to Restore Balance, Happiness, and Productivity, named by the Globe and Mail as the number one best business and management book of 2023 and chosen as the season 20 selection of the Next Big Idea Book Club. Thank you so much for being here today and for talking a little bit with the audience of Beyond the Thesis with Papa PhD.
It's a pleasure.
Now, Gloria, of course, your bio, it's really a very short and condensed journey across what you've done scientifically and in terms of communication in the last few years. But before we go into why I invited you, maybe, and the subjects of today, which has to do with focus and attention, maybe you could share with the audience what brought you to research, what kind of was your journey towards what you decided or what you ended up working on and focusing your research work on, because I know it wasn't a straightforward path, right? It's kind of a roundabout story.
That's right. So, you know, my first degree was in fine art, in painting and drawing, and never thought I would do anything else. But that didn't last too long because the reality of making a living as an artist kind of hit home. And I realized I would so much rather do something that I enjoy 8 hours a day than working as, say, a taxi driver 8 hours a day to support my art, which many artists unfortunately do. As it turns out, you know, 8 hours a day is kind of a dream because it's more like, you know, 12 or 15 hours a day, but we can get to that later on. I had other skills. I was good at math, and I thought I could do something with math. And I ended up going into a graduate program in psychology, which actually uses a lot of math. Experimental psychology, you can say, in some ways, is applied statistics. So, but I was fascinated by psychology, and I went to Columbia. Got a PhD there. And then I went to work at a research lab. Met my husband, went to Germany, worked at a research lab there. And then both of us decided it's time to come back to the U.S. And I got a job at University of California, Irvine, where I have been since the year 2000.
There you go. And now it's very interesting that you mentioned this going to Germany and then coming back to the States, because in your book, I've listened to the audiobook version of it in preparation for this interview. There's a a section in the book where you actually talk about something that was different between your life and your interaction with computers and also the pace of your day in Germany and the culture around lunchtime, etc., versus when you arrived at Irvine. And it's really interesting. It was really interesting to me how that kind of was a burgeoning moment of then what you focused on in your research. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So, you know, in Germany, the main meal of the day is called Mittagessen. You could think of it as the warm meal of the day. And people, you know, around lunchtime, around noon, a colleague would come around, gather people up, and as a group, we would go to the restaurant. There was a restaurant on the campus, and we'd sit and we'd have our big, large, warm meal, sitting as a large group, chatting, and then we would take a walk around this campus. It was quite a beautiful campus, and it's in German, you call it a Rund. You know, you take a round. For about 20 minutes, come back, you're refreshed, you start your afternoon. So it was a really nice break. In 2000, I came back to the US, and all of a sudden, I was just inundated with a lot of different projects. Now, in Germany, I worked in a research lab, so I pretty much just had one project to work on. There were other people who wrote grants. We didn't have students, we had colleagues, so it was a very different kind of work culture. As an academic in the U.S., suddenly I have teaching, you know, classes to teach, students to mentor, was writing grants, I had different research projects to manage, I was sitting on committees, both at the university, also doing things for the larger research community. Reviewing papers, sitting on program committees. It was really a bit crazy. Lunchtime was very different in the U.S., at least at, you know, at UC Irvine where I was, because it was all I could do to get a break between classes or meetings, run to the cafeteria, buy a sandwich or salad, race back to my office. My office was located at the end of a very long corridor. And as I was racing back to my office, I would look in at everybody's open doors and I would see everyone sitting in front of their computers eating their lunch, right? Sitting, eating a sandwich. And I'd slip into my chair and I would do exactly the same thing. So it, you know, there was no long, relaxed lunch break with colleagues chatting, talking about tech news, gossiping, and then taking a nice walk, leisurely walk, I should say, but rather sitting in front of my computer. So lunch represented rather a break from getting back on the computer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you say that some people were even in front of your computer eating their lunch. So not much of a break there.
And I did too. I did exactly the same.
So two very different realities, and the change here is geographical, but also in the context of your work, of course. But I feel that in your book is very timely in the sense that we, ever since the evolution of smartphones to what they are today, we are evolving towards always being in front of a screen or having a screen in the vicinity. And so I guess... this kind of two different realities that had to do with you moving and changing roles, now it's become an evolution in time of the whole society. Everyone is now has less breaks from being in front of different types of screens, and of course this is the focus of a lot of what you've studied and published about.
That's right. Yeah.
And now, the reason why I heard your episode on Hidden Brain and something really clicked for me, because I went back to my
thesis writing time when I was finishing my PhD and thinking what a struggle it was to focus on this task that if you condensate it, you know, it could have taken a few weeks, but of course that's not what happens. We are, like you said, kind of buffeted by different, like you say in the book, by different stimuli, etc., different priorities, different habits. And also, we need to share some of our bandwidth with other activities, other responsibilities. But it is true that some of this interruption and some of this difficulty in having long stretches of very productive work has some explanations that you go deep into in the book that has to do with things that come from within us, things that come from the outside, and also the way we are wired as humans to work and to have different paces and different chapters to our day and to our morning. I found that really, really interesting, and I immediately thought that a big part of the audience of Beyond the Thesis would really gain from hearing and learning about how they work, how their wiring works, and why it's difficult to work many, many hours in that deep mode, but also to learn about strategies on how to make the best of how the human brain works to be the most productive and also the most healthy in their mental health and also physical health. Is there something that you've heard again and again, and that's a good place to start our conversation about finding this focus and this attention and optimizing it based on all your findings?
I actually want to back up a little, and I want to say even before the stage of thesis writing, I would say the number one reason why it takes students a long time to graduate is not knowing what they want to do, not being able to decide on their thesis topic. And the reason is because students believe and are told that, you know, this is going to define you. Your thesis will define you. Your job will depend on your thesis. There's so much pressure to think about making this great discovery, you know, writing this, impactful thesis. When in fact, the advice that my advisor gave me is that your life begins after your thesis, right? You get your thesis done, get it over with, and then your life begins. So once students know what they want to do, then, you know, that's a big step. I like a saying that differentiates Japanese from Americans. So they say that it takes Americans, they spend 90% of the time making a decision and 10% of the time making it work. The Japanese spend 10% of the time making a decision, 90% of the time making it work. And so I think this can apply to writing a thesis, right? You've made your decision, okay? Now you put your time into making that decision work, whatever that problem is. There are so many ways that problems can be made interesting, right? The way you frame it, the way you choose to investigate it. So putting one's effort into making that part of it work, right? Okay, here's your research question. You've settled on that. Now let's make it work. So putting some time into the planning of it, right? To make sure it's, you know, you're just milking it for as much as you can. What I mean by that is you're really thinking deeply about that question, and you're really trying to research it in such a way that it can really provide something insightful. And so it requires a little bit of thought, planning, right? Rather than just jumping in and then realizing a little bit down the road that this may not have been the best path. So I would say putting time into planning is really, really important. And, you know, for me, when I worked on my own thesis, I had worked on a problem that hadn't been worked on before. So it was a little bit easy because, you know, no, whatever I did was going to be new, right? And so, you know, it was just a matter of executing it. And it was an experimental psychology problem. It was about group decision making. And it was a lot of work to get experimental subjects. I think I might have broken a record at Columbia University at the time, maybe not since, but at the time, for just the sheer number of people who I ran in experimental studies.
Very good. This is interesting, the question of planning before you take the dive, let's say, and the same way you can plan for a thesis, you can also plan for a day or plan for a week in thinking about your focus and attention instead of just reacting to them and being kind of subject to the variations in attention and a focus that come naturally during the day, during the week, etc. Anyway, I found that really interesting. And I wonder whether there's an aspect, you know, maybe this question of gaining agency that you can talk a little bit about. What are ways to kind of regain or increase your agency in the face of these different challenges that come during a day, during a week, during a semester?
The first thing I would say is to consider that we humans have a limited attentional capacity. And it's really important to be aware of that. You know, we don't have unlimited attention. We do if something is very easy. If we're using what's called automatic attention, if you're driving a straight route, you can drive for, you know, 8 hours, no problem, because it's not cognitively taxing on your mind. But if you have to do something that's involving a lot of cognitive effort, like reading a difficult article, that's going to drain these limited attentional resources that we have. So the first thing is be aware of that, right? And most people schedule their day, right? They write a to-do list. And your plan is you want to finish a chapter by 1 o'clock, and then you want to start another chapter, you know, right after that. Instead, consider the fact that our attentional resources wax and wane over the course of the day. And I use the metaphor of having a tank. Getting a good night's sleep is one of the best ways that you can help yourself, because you start your day with a full tank of attentional resources. And as the day progresses, the tank is going to drain. It's a function of the time since waking. But there's other things we do during the day that also drain this tank. Like focusing really hard on tough things can really wear us down. Not taking breaks, boy, that's a recipe for getting exhausted. And multitasking, which is shifting our attention very rapidly between different screens, because every time you switch your attention, there's a switch cost. You have to reorient to this new task that you're doing, and you have to summon up what's called a new schema about this new task, and that drains us to keep doing it rapidly throughout the day. So think about designing your day instead. Figure out what your peak focus times are. That's not hard. I mean, people have a good sense of what their chronotype is. You know, are you an early type? You work best in earlier. you're a late type, you don't get started until, you know, 11 o'clock or so, or a moderate. I'm a moderate type. I don't do well if I'm up at the crack of dawn, but I also don't start too late in the day either. And you could just keep a simple diary of, you know, when you feel that your attention is at its peak. What we've done in our research is ask people two very simple questions. How challenged were you and how engaged were you in the thing you were just doing? Just keep a simple diary. Do this for a few days. I do this as an exercise with my students, and it works. And it's generally the case that people have two peaks. One peak for most people is mid-morning and then again mid-afternoon. For myself, I'm not good at starting my day right off diving into really hard work. Some people can do it. I like to do what I call subordinate tasks, like getting email out of the way. If I don't get it out of the way, it lingers in my mind and I wonder, oh, maybe there was an email I should have looked at. So I look at it first and get it out of the way, but I design my day. And designing your day is figuring out the most important tasks and work to do at those peak times of your attention. So be intentional at that. Also, design breaks into your day because less is more. Remember that tank of resources? You can replenish that tank by taking a break. The best break is to get outside for 20 minutes if you can. That's just a wonderful way to get refreshed. If you can't get outside, you know, move around inside, which is great. But even doing rote work can help because it can help calm us, help our minds kind of settle down. People can do, you know, people have told me they do knitting, or they, you know, you can do some very simple activity. The poet and writer Maya Angelou did very simple crossword puzzles to replenish herself, you know, to just pull back. Your mind is still working when you're doing these other things. And if you've got a really tough problem and you step away, it gives your mind a chance to kind of think about that problem. You're not doing it really at a conscious level, but you're getting yourself replenished, coming back, and sometimes the answer can be really clear. So, you know, there are other things we can do as well. I like to practice what I call meta-awareness, which is an awareness of what we're doing in the moment. And there's so many things that we do that we're just not conscious about. For example, we see our phone. I've got my phone right next to me. We pick it up and we swipe it open and we're not thinking about it consciously. It's an automatic action. We see a notification, we click on it. We have an urge to go on social media, we simply switch screens, switch windows, and go to social media. These are automatic actions that we can actually control, and we can control them by becoming more aware of our actions when we do those. And it's a so I probe myself, and I've learned to recognize when I have these urges. And I ask myself, do I really need to read the news right now? Do I really need to go to social media? And chances are no, but I have brought that urge into my conscious awareness. I can become intentional. I can form a plan, and I can say, okay, I'm going to reward myself in 30 minutes. I'm going to work 30 minutes longer, and then I'm going to go and take a break and, you know, read the news.
Mm-hmm. And so, be intentional about it, yeah.
And be intentional. So, you know, meta-awareness is about being aware of what you're doing. And I think it can also help with anxiety. People have so much anxiety about the future. I've been there, my students have been there, and anxiety just, it eats into our attentional resources. It eats into the time that we should be devoting to work in the present. We should be thinking about the present. We should be thinking about the work in front of us and not worrying about job prospects or, oh my God, will this paper get accepted or rejected? But, you know, you're doing one step at a time. You're paying attention to what's in front of you, and you take it step by step in the present.
Mm-hmm. So from what you've just said in the last few minutes, it feels one of the aspects that I find, and you just talked about meta-awareness, is, and I think the chronotype piece also is in that domain, which is to know yourself and to be able to take a step back and have kind of a bird's eye view of yourself, of how your body works, at what time of the day you have the most resources, etc. And I think it's really important. But one of the things often that can happen in graduate school, and I remember, you know, living or going through these feelings, is comparing yourselves to people that are in the next, you know, in the next lab or on the bench beside you, and it feels like you really need to find your pace. You really need to find your chronotype, and I think, and I always try to tell students not to compare themselves with anyone, and to focus on their job, because. And I tell them, very often you think everything's going well for the other person. And then if I go ask the other person how they are, they're thinking everything is going well with you. So now, so that, I think that really aligns with the last thing you said, which is focus on the step by step, and you will be building this wall of knowledge that eventually, you know, will lead to your publishing it or et cetera, et cetera. But it's tough. There's a lot of anxiety, like you said, and there's a lot of self-projected or self-inflicted comparison, negativity, and feelings of overwhelm because you're not going just step by step and just trusting that if I do one day of work tomorrow, I will have one day of work behind me. And it's and anyway, I. I'm really happy that you mentioned that.
Yeah, it's about gaining agency over your actions. And, you know, we, as I mentioned, we do so many things automatically and we don't question them. We just, you know, we see a notification, we click on it, and we're not thinking. If you bring it into conscious awareness, you see that notification, and then we can say, ah, I don't need to click on that, right? So it really is quite valuable, I found.
And now, still on this question, what price do you pay when you interrupt something? Let's say you're writing a paragraph or something important, and there's a notification or there of an email or a message, and you interrupt, you read the message, and you act upon it. What's the price that you pay in terms of the work that you had been developing and that you stopped?
Yeah, it's it can be a big price. It interrupts your train of thought. We know from decades of laboratory research that when people are given tasks where they're interrupted, we know that they make more errors. We know that it creates stress. My own research has shown that people are stressed when they're interrupting themselves, switching their attention. And we know it takes longer. And I talked about the idea of a switch cost, that every time you switch, you're, you know, I have to bring up this new schema, this new information about the task at hand. It's a cost, right? It's a cost on our attention and it's a cost on time. So it's not good. It's better to monotask, which is to work on one task through to completion or to a breakpoint. And a breakpoint is a logical place to end your task, which could be the end of a chapter, or maybe you're reading a paper, you read through the end of a section, right? because it's a lot easier to pick up again. And when you, you know, interrupt something in the middle of a task without a break point, you know, people end up doing redundant work, and you know, you have to read over the material again to refresh your mind. So it's so much better and much more efficient to look for those breakpoints or, you know, finish the task.
Some people, or a lot of people actually, and I know in the thesis writing groups, etc., they're using this technique, the Pomodoro technique. I don't know if you've heard of it. Is this something that fits in that way of organizing yourself? They're saying, you know what, until my timer says I've done my 50 minutes or whatever time you decided, I'm going to ignore anything else, that notifications, etc., that come up. Does this make sense?
Yeah, I mean, if it works for someone, that's fine. I personally don't like it because I think it's so much better for a person to design their day based on their own attentional rhythm. The problem with Pomodoro, from my perspective, is that at the end of 25 minutes, you're interrupted, right? And you take a break, which is good, gives you a chance to replenish, but that might not be the best time to be interrupted. Right. I would so much rather have the individual in control of when to take a pause, when to take a break, and when to come back. But you know, if a person likes Pomodoro, it's effective for them, that's okay. But you know, there's a bit of a cost to that method too.
Because you might be in, let's say, which is something you're talking about in the book, you might be in flow and then it rings and it stops it there. And you could have stayed another 30 minutes and done something great. Of course, I understand. But I do think it's for someone who feels really disorganized and interrupted and who has a difficulty unplugging, it could be a first way of starting this journey of getting agency and control on their attention. One concept that you talk about, talk about attentional rhythm, and it's I think it relates a little bit with what we said. It has to do with learning when in the day. It has to do with the chronotype, and when in the day you should definitely not answer emails. Are there other exercises you can do besides the kind of journaling that you mentioned to really, you know, learn and be totally cognizant of what your attentional rhythm is? And is it more of something along during an hour, or are there daily rhythms that you can or even in a larger span that you can also define for yourself?
I think it's good to start with a daily rhythm. Having a good understanding of what your daily rhythm is. If you know your attentional peak is going to start at say 10 a.m., don't waste that energy by doing don't go on social media, don't do email, but really spend that time doing your important work. So that's really important. I mean, another technique that I find very valuable is whenever we're tempted to, divert our attention, or whenever we lose motivation to doing something, imagine your future self. Now, I like to imagine my future self at the end of the day. So where do I want to be at 7 o'clock in the evening? And importantly, how do I want to feel? Where I want to be is I want to be relaxing. I want to be sitting on the couch. I want to be reading, you know, or maybe watching a fun show or talking with someone. The last thing I want to be doing is working on a deadline. And I say this from experience, where I have spent years working through the evening, getting myself really exhausted, and it's not worth it. It really, and it impacts us the next day as well. So imagine your future self. How do I want to feel? I want to feel fulfilled. I want to feel rewarded. I want to feel like, boy, I put in a good day of work, and I want to feel satisfied. So if it's, 11 o'clock in the morning and or let's say it's 1 o'clock and you're starting to feel a lack of motivation, think about your future self, and that can drum up that internal motivation to get you going again, because that's where you want to be at the end of the day. Now, if we're thinking of a broader timeline, if we're thinking of graduate school, students may also want to think of where they want to be at the end of the road, at the end of graduate school. Imagine yourself, do you want to be a professor, or maybe want to be, working in a research lab, or, imagine where you want to see yourself at the end of your program. And, imagine yourself getting that diploma, imagine yourself defending your dissertation in front of your committee. Those are the kinds of future self imaginings that people can do, which can also help motivate. So, instead of getting stuck in a rut in the present, think ahead to the future, and it can help pull us out of that rut and give us fuel to keep going.
No, it makes total sense to me. And I usually advise people to imagine different. Of course, there's probably a favorite goal or a first choice, but to imagine different. Today Marvel is all the rage. To imagine a multiverse of things that they might be at the end, and how what they're doing is leading to that potentially. I love it, but I had never. And again, this is in the book too. I had never. Whenever someone says your future self, my brain doesn't go towards later today. It's always larger, broader, but I really, really like it. It's really different, and it was unexpected and powerful, I think. Powerful because it kind of, again, puts things in perspective, because you do get in a rut, you do get stuck, especially, let's say, something is not working with your research. You then get super laser focused on, I have to fix that now, today, tonight. And often you can mess up a whole week of your work because you got stuck in that. And I feel from all I read and from what you shared that often if you've spent already too much time on a problem, your cognitive resources are hyper low, and that extra work is just gonna be digging a bigger hole that you then need to get yourself out of. So what are ways to identify, okay, I'm in a loop here and not, or I'm doing like this huge amount of work that's amounting to nothing. I need to stop and actually replenish somehow. It's complicated because of the time pressure of being in graduate school. Time is always, you always feel like I don't have any time to breathe. But of course, there is time. There is, of course, a limited amount of time, but psychologically, we're often not there. What are ways to break these cycles of tunnel vision and of too much investment in something that clearly needs some steps back and some reorienting?
Yeah, so that goes back to the idea of meta-awareness and probing yourself to become more aware of what your actions are. And so, if you're really stuck in something, you can probe yourself and you realize you're stuck and maybe it's time to step away. Probe yourself to ask, are you tired? Are you exhausted? Do you need a break? Because, research shows that a mere 20 minutes in nature can de-stress people and lead people to be more creative. We've done research. We show that 20 minutes in nature can lead people to have better divergent thinking, which is more ideas, more creative ideas. It's like brainstorming. So, you know, people have this notion, I can't step away from my computer because, you know, it's time away from work. But the idea of less is more is very valuable. By stepping away, letting your brain refresh, you can come back and actually do more. So I think a lot of the problem that students have is not being efficient, right? And I think you really pointed it out very nicely when you talked about, you know, you're just kind of in a rut. You're thinking about things over and over again. Probe yourself and ask yourself, you know, am I in a rut? Am I moving forward? Am I getting stuck? And if you are, it's time to step away, right? And so probing yourself is a little bit awkward at first. We forget to do it. But the more you do it, it becomes second nature. And it just becomes part of our it's a ritual, right? It's part of a ritual. And it helps propel us throughout the day. So I would say, you know, practice. The kinds of probes you can ask are, okay, I have this urge to read the news. Do I really need to do that right now? Or how do I feel? Do I feel exhausted? Or am I really making progress on reading this article? Or am I just stuck on this paragraph? If you're just stuck, okay, take a break, come back, and then you'll be able to have a lot more energy.
It's really interesting, and it's kind of feels like you're kind of switching between being the driver, where you're doing the things, and then becoming a passenger and looking at what's happening. And it's not a natural thing to, yeah, it's not something that would come naturally. But you said you just mentioned one now, and it's kind of escaped me. Like, how am I feeling, or you know, how energetic am I feeling now? And if you gain this habit, of course you can act more on this knowledge. And I really, really like it. And now, something you mentioned, walking in nature. And you also mentioned right at the beginning that when you were in Germany, the walk, the Rund, is that how you call right. it? Was a part and parcel of that Mittagessen experience.
Yes, yes.
And it feels like you had it all, you know, all these things, or a bunch of these positive things that you mentioned, having a break, discussing ideas with people who probably weren't working in the exact same as you, and going out and walking and being in nature. It feels to me that it should also be something that, if possible, graduate students who are not PIs yet and don't have all the admin, etc., they should kind of integrate in their day-to-day, a moment of communion with other people, of real pause, of not being in front of a screen, and of being outside. Now, there's one thing, and we are reaching the end of the interview, but there's one thing that you mentioned, and that I think is something that will work for me. It has to do with the Zeigarnik effect. So you kind of mentioned it before in a different way, which was, for me, it's good to take the emails off my mind in the morning by taking care of them. But the example you state in the book is to not go to sleep if you have things bubbling in your mind that are still keeping your attention and maybe some level of anxiety, and to offload them onto a notebook, some sort of other support. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think it's so simple, yet so powerful.
Yeah. So the Zeigarnik effect, this was discovered by a woman named Bluma Zeigarnik about 100 years ago in Berlin. And she found that when people were interrupted from tasks, they remembered those tasks better than tasks they had completed. Why is that the case? Well, you know, you finish a task, it's done, it's off your plate. When you haven't finished a task, there's some tension in you. And the tension is, you know, you have to finish it. And that tension is what keeps that memory in us. And so when you're about to sleep, you know, we tend to ruminate over tasks that we haven't finished. And, you know, I heard about one theory, I don't know if this is true or not, that one reason why we ruminate at night about unfinished things is because we want to make sure we don't forget them. You know, it's a way to kind of rehearse it. I don't know if that's true or not. It does make a lot of sense to me. But if you write things down, and there is a study that showed that if you write them down, people sleep better. And, you know, it's offloading all of those memories, right? That tension onto a piece of paper. You've got it recorded. You're not going to forget it. When you wake up, you can see what needs to be done. So, I find that very, very effective. And by the way, this also, and I read that it can work not just with unfinished tasks, but with any kind of problem that a person has anxiety about. You have anxiety about, oh my God, is my paper going to get accepted? Write that down. You know, keep a journal by your bed and write these things down so that you're offloading them, taking them out of your mind so you don't have to keep replaying them in your mind. Put it on a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm, to stop the rumination. I think it's so, so simple and again, potentially so powerful. Gloria, we are reaching the end of this hour talking. Anyway, before I ask you some questions about where to find your book, for example. I still just want to kind of give my impressions that I and my take homes from what you shared. And one word that sticks with me is agency, and it had stuck with me while reading while listening to the audiobook. And I remember, especially by the end of my PhD, feeling disoriented and kind of, like I said before, like buffeted in a kind of a storm of, you know, time running out, money running out, you know, revisions needing to be made, etc. It's experiments needing to be redone, and you lose agency. You know, it's easy to lose agency. And what I feel that is really powerful on the work that you've done and on how you put it in the book is that, anyway, it allowed me to kind of step back and see why our minds work in a certain way, and how to then, especially through meta-awareness, how to then also kind of step back, get into the passenger seat instead of the driver's seat, and say, why am I turning here now? Why am I going 100 miles an hour? You know, maybe I don't need to go at this pace, or maybe actually I need to stop and go refill this metaphorical car. And I think this is to me what I'm taking home, and the center of what I'm taking home from what I read and from our conversation, which is you may be disoriented, anxious, etc., but you are inside, within yourself, without anything else and anyone else, have this ability and this possibility of getting this meta-awareness. And of course, if you read the book, you get some vocabulary, which always, to me at least, always helps dealing with a new concept, having vocabulary around it. And I really liked the idea of kinetic attention. I had never heard it, and I found it really interesting. But for the people who are listening, who are especially writing a paper or maybe dealing with this experiment that's not functioning, take some time to replenish. While you're taking this time, if you can take some time to take a step back and reflect about why you're anxious or why you're frazzled or why you're overwhelmed, it's going to help you then decide. And if you do this third thing, which is the last one that I'm going to mention, of viewing yourself as a future you, not 10 years from now, although that's also interesting, but 24 years from now or 12 hours from now, I mean, all of these are actually very simple ways of regaining agency. And I find it really inspiring. And I think the simplicity of all of them, to me, is what makes the power of your research and of what you shared in the book So I just wanted to kind of sum that up because it's really, I find it really striking, and that I, the potential to help this community whom you know very well, I think is very, very strong. Now, I don't know if you had a, if you want to say something. It's
No, just say thank you. I think that was a good summary.
Now, Gloria, the book, where do people get it? Can they go on Amazon? What the keywords should they put in there to find your book? And also, where do they go to reach out to you if they want to ask you something after listening to this interview, or you know, just get in touch with you?
Sure. So at the bottom of the screen, scrolling, is www.gloriamark.com. If you go there, you know, that can give you a link to purchase the book. The book is called Attention Span. You can also go to Amazon, search for Attention Span, or search for my name. I also have a Substack that I've become very obsessed about recently. And I would like to invite you all to subscribe to it because I talk about these kinds of topics. So I publish it every week. And it's gloriamark.substack.com. So, I invite you to subscribe and would love to hear from you. You can reach me at www.gloriamark.com.
Excellent. And if you've listened to this interview and if you have a story, something to share about focus, about attention, you can write an email to attention@papaphd.com, and it's going to be a pleasure for me to relay it to Gloria, but also then to share it if you want, and to give you a shout out in a future episode. Gloria, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your all the know-how and the stories even that you shared here today. Again, I think there's a lot of value there, and there's a lot of very actionable information there that's easy to implement, and I really trust that this episode is going to be of inspiration, of help to a lot of people out there working on their thesis and you know, struggling to get to the end of it. So thank you so much.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to another Beyond the Thesis conversation with me, David Mendez, and my guest, Gloria Mark. If you'd like to support the show and help me produce more interviews like this, just go to papaphd.com/PayPal and donate there. And if you want to help a little bit more, please go to papaphd.com/audience and fill in the survey that is there for you and leave a comment so I can give you a shout out in a future episode. Thank you for being a fan, happy listening, and happy sharing.